This is Business Impact, a podcast series from UCD College of Business, Ireland's leading business school. I'm your host, Emmett Oliver, and each episode I'll be joined by world-renowned faculty from across the College of Business, as well as international industry leaders who'll offer us insight, spark curiosity, and challenge you to rethink how you do business in a changing world. Now, good afternoon, everybody. You're very welcome along to what is a special edition of our Business Impact podcast, which we normally do in my box room at home. So I've decided to come out from the closet, literally. I've only come out for special occasions and special guests. And the guest today is a very special guest indeed, because he's probably the only guest we'll have ever had whose name is pretty much everywhere behind us, underneath us, in here as well. So a lot of students will know, obviously, the name Quinn, because they're studying here and you opted to take modules and courses here, but you probably have never met the man that has given the name. Maybe some of you have from your time. He generously partnered up with the school a long time ago, and we'll get talking about that in a few minutes. And he's delighted to come back here. He comes back reasonably often. Lachlan is born in Dublin, educated in Blackrock College, and was the driving force for many decades behind Glen Dimplex. Now, those of you who don't know Glen Dimplex, you probably do, because you've probably opened one of their fridges, or you've probably had one of their vacuum cleaners. A lot of electrical goods that are either made by them or one of their brands is probably in your apartment, flat or house, even though you may not necessarily always know that. That was one of his business interests. He's also a former auditor from a long time ago with Arthur Anderson, and he is a BCom graduate of this school when it was under a different name and back in the city centre, which people not necessarily remember at this stage, in Earlsford Terrace in Dublin city centre. He's also an enthusiastic wine grower, owner of a vineyard. He's also served on a number of state companies, chairing the Allied Irish Banks and ESB as well, of course, our national utility. He also, for many years, has been an investor in property around the world, across Europe as well, and has a big interest, I know, in art, in the National Gallery. He has his own art collection. He's also been involved in IMA and a number of other projects. A lot of it takes too long to talk to. He's now, I suppose, in semi-retirement. Would that be a fair way to describe it, give or take? Still busy enough. If you'd welcome our guest, Lachlan Quinn, for today's conversation. So, Lachlan, first of all, welcome along. The first thing is that when you look at people in front of you, a number of them will be students. You were obviously in UCD in a different place in the city centre. What kind of a student were you? You were born at the start of World War II. You went to college as late 50s, early 60s?
Went to college 59.
59. And what kind of a UCD commerce student were you?
I got a very good pass degree. I remember talking at one of the reunions of the classes here in Belfield. I remember remarking to one of my fellow students, I said, the big difference between us and the current group of students is nowadays you have to get a good degree. In our day, you only had to get a degree.
A degree.
Anything suited. There were so few people at university.
Yeah, it was a precious thing to go then, right? I mean, not all of your schoolmates would have gone. Presumably, they went off straight into the workplace.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So not everyone went. What do you remember most about being in college in the city centre, the kind of other students you had, your friends, your pals?
Essentially, the social life. It was all about the social life. It was very unpressurised. I don't even remember if people failed their exams. There were a few small group of people who got first class honours. They were unusual. But the rest of us got, as I say, good pass degrees.
And had you any idea what you wanted to do at that point while you were studying away? Or was it just something to do with business, accountancy, something in that vague area? Or were you very purposeful about what you wanted to kind of move into after college?
Well, when I finished and got my degree, I didn't know what I wanted to do. But I decided I'd go back to university and do philosophy. So I went back and they said you're exempt from doing first year philosophy, you go into second year. And by February, I decided this was a bore because all my friends had left. So I decided the only thing I could do was accountancy. Quite a few of my friends had done accountancy and I'd done a degree in commerce. So I started accountancy 6 months after, really, I got my BCom.
And what did everyone say to you when you said, I'm off to do philosophy to go back to college? What did your family say and so on?
I think my father must have taken a deep breath because he said, OK, but I don't know that anybody was impressed.
You must be the only, I'd say you're probably the only business student who's also done philosophy and vice versa.
Well, 6 months of it.
Yeah, well, there was an interest there, right? There was an interest. Do you remember much about graduating? Do you remember the Ireland of the time? I mean, this is a world that probably is hard to explain to people of a younger generation. You're talking about the late 50s. Ireland had come through a really rough 50s. The 50s were not good for the country. We hadn't reached that bouncy 1960s feeling. So what, can you just give us a sense of what things were like? Are you just younger, so you didn't notice that sort of glue hanging around?
One, you didn't notice a lot. I mean, I had got my degree before I was 21. The social life was really all that was important. Having been to Black Rock, most of my classmates lived local. You know, people didn't travel very far to school. The social life took over. I would say typical middle-class Dublin family of the time.
And in terms of what you did then, you moved into Arthur Anderson. Was that straight after, or did you have other...
No, I qualified with a small firm in Dublin. Coming late, the bigger firms had already hired people. A friend of mine had a sister who worked in a small accounting firm in Ely Place, and she arranged for me to join them. I qualified there.
And you eventually then moved into Arthur Anderson, which for people who may not know, and it's a very circuitous explanation, but Accenture, the current consultancy company, grew out of Arthur Anderson. We won't go into all that now because it would suck up a big chunk of time. But talk to us about your work in Arthur Anderson doing audit. I mean, what kind of an auditor were you in terms of, how would you describe it?
There's no office in Dublin, so I did the usual thing. In those days, the number of people with an education or a postgraduate degree or a qualification, quite few. Getting a job was not difficult. I applied to about 10 firms in London and I got 10 offers. Not because of me, but because there was just a shortage of qualified accountants and the economy in Europe was expanding quite dramatically. You know, it had started in the 50s, post-World War II. France was growing, England was growing, Germany was growing. It was a very buoyant economic time, so getting a job was easy. Of the different firms that offered me a job, I picked Arthur Anderson for 3 years working in around the UK, Israel, the Lebanon, sometimes the United States, Switzerland. So I saw a lot of different cultures and business in a lot of different countries. And it was just endlessly fascinating. And then they decided to open an office in Dublin in 69. And they asked me to come back and head up the audit practice.
Now, you were going up against your sort of Stokes, Kennedy, Crowleys and so on, right? That were Cooper's Library didn't exist at that point.
Well, much smaller firm than it is today, yeah.
But you had to build up the Arthur Anderson name in Ireland. It wasn't as
I think we had about 6 clients when we opened the office.
Yeah. So how did you get the growth you got? Because
there was a fair amount of American investment into Ireland at that stage through the IDA and manufacturing plants all over the country. And Arthur Anderson were in the top 4 in the United States at the time. You know, 20, 25, 30% of these clients were captive clients. They just automatically rang us up and said, will you advise us on opening an office where we should go and look? There was an automatic overseas investment which came into the office and we grew. So when the office opened, there were about 7 of us. And when I left, which was about 10 years later, we had 140 people in the office.
Did you do the hiring or were there other people who were hiring?
I was in charge of recruitment for about 3 years, yeah.
What did you look for in an auditor? What was the thing that you, apart from the technical specifications, which most of them presumably had, was there something that you looked for in the hiring? What made a good auditor at that time? A
very straightforward hiring policy. Avoid first-class honours people. They tend to be a bit nerdy.
Sorry, folks.
Go for people with second-class honours. Then you don't have to ask them about their results or anything because they're clearly bright. And then you used to see, will they fit in with the rest of the people in the office? What do they do in their spare time? What interests them? What amuses them? And the way we did the interview process in those days, I don't know what they do nowadays, but in those days, we'd have 3 people interview, not at the same time, 3 separately. So you were interviewed by somebody who was 2 years ahead of you or 3 years ahead of you. And then afterwards we discussed that person will fit, that person won't. You could take the brain power for granted.
That's a lot of what happens now, you know. You get interviewed by different people within the company at different interview sets. That's actually quite, you were ahead of your time there in that, just in that mode of recruitment. So you're going along, the company's doing well, you're building it up, you're hiring people, you're over 100 staff, you're given a good bit of competitive bite to the other firms, you're head of the audit practice, presumably you're doing well, family life is good and all the rest, and then you make a decision, and this to me sounds like a kind of a sliding doors moment for your career, is that you decide in the late 1970s to join this company called Glenn Electric at the time, right? I know you knew Martin Nocton from previous, the other driving force of Glenn Dimplex, but I know what the pull factors were pulling into that company, but were there any push factors? Were there things that made you say, I've taken auditing as far as I want to, I'm a certain age, this is the moment? What were the things that made you say, I'm going to take up this, what was a kind of a startup name in Ireland at the time?
Well, nobody had really heard of Glenn Electric. And it was, relatively speaking, a small company. But I was coming up to the age of 40, and I figured, if I don't move now, I'm going to spend the rest of my life auditing, which I enjoyed. I was doing well in Arthur Andersen. By relative standards, I was on a good salary. Because in Arthur Andersen, if you were a partner, unlike the other accounting firms, you were a worldwide partner. So you shared the profits of New York, Chicago, Paris, London. Whereas the other firms had local partnerships, but Arthur Andersen was one global partnership. So it was very difficult. I went back and forward, one day I'd say yes, the next day I'd say no. It took me about 3 months, but eventually I decided to move.
And what did people around you say?
A lot of surprise.
Yeah, I mean, the Irish tradition would be, you're in a accountancy practice, who are Glenn Electric,
stay where you are,
solid, dependable, pensionable job, what do you do?
It was a bit, a lot of my friends were surprised.
Yeah. Maybe because you'd done the philosophy decades ago, they said this guy is occasionally known to throw the odd surprise at us, you know. Obviously, the person presumably bidding for your services was Martin Nocton, who I understand from talking to you, you had worked with before. Can you just give us a little bit of the audience a sense of this other person? Because the two of you kind of were the driving forces behind Glenn Dimplex for years. You were known as the kind of a bit of a duo. Why did you get on in the first place, or why have you always got on?
I first met him before he left the company he was originally working in, Electrical Industries of Ireland, which nobody here would have heard about, but it was the biggest manufacturing company in Ireland. They employed 1,600 people in 1972 in Dunleer, County Louth. And it was built up behind tariff barriers. So instead of being a factory, it looked more like a department store. It made every electrical product you could think of. So the people in the company had a lot of skills, but it was a ridiculous company, making irons, toasters, heaters, fridges, washing machines, you name it, in small volumes. And they signed a free trade agreement with the UK in 1965. That was the death knell for that factory. I was brought in 1972. The Irish government wanted to find out what was happening because of the jobs. I recommended the factory be closed. It had no future. Martin Nocton was the factory manager.
I was going to say, did he ever thank you for that?
Oh, we got to know each other.
Right, he didn't hold it against you that you...
No, he didn't. And he knew himself it had to be closed. He knew himself... And he had a plan for a slimmed-down version of the business that would employ 100 people, not 14 or 1,500, 100 people. But the government had no confidence in the team. Everybody got lost. They failed. And they brought in a group of guys from Cadbury's to run it. We subsequently bought that business in 1979, when I was still advising Glenn Electric. But that was where I got to know Martin. So Martin decided he'd set up a business with his plan, 100 people making 3 products, and he'd sell to the multiples in the UK. Never even thought about the Irish market. And he went to Newry and he got a grant from the Northern Ireland Development Agency. In those days, the troubles were in full swing. No jobs in Northern Ireland. They were hemorrhaging jobs everywhere. So manna from heaven, somebody wants to open a factory. So he got me to negotiate with them for a grant package for a new factory in Newry. And that's where Glenn Electric got started. And then, because I was essentially, my main job in life was being an auditor, I said to Martin, I'd like the audit. That's my job. And we did a deal, and Glenn Electric became a client of mine.
And do you ever think back and say, what if I hadn't moved in those late 70s? Where would I be sitting now?
Well, it's a sort of foolish speculation, you know. It doesn't get you anywhere.
Yeah. But it was the right choice, right?
Well, it ended up being right. I mean, yeah. Lots of people make lots of choices, and some work and some don't work. And you can be lucky or you can be unlucky. I mean, a lot of businesses don't work out, and it's not your fault. A lot of businesses do work out, and you're lucky to have been there.
For people who might know some of the brands that the company were behind, Creda, Morphy Richards,
Elling.
Any other ones you want to mention that might...
Roberts Radio.
Yes.
Dimplex itself, of course, which was the main brand. And then subsequently, they were just the English companies we bought. We got a telephone call one day from a bank wanting to know, was Dimplex for sale? No, it's not for sale. Who wants to buy it? Can't tell you. Well, it's hard to say no if you won't tell us who it was. So it was Siemens in Germany wanted to buy it. So we met Siemens and we said, it's not for sale. Siemens then said, okay, will you do a joint venture with us? We said, no, you're too big. And then they said, will you buy us? Because Siemens had a policy at that stage. If they weren't number one, two or three in the world, they wanted out. And they needed to buy Dimplex at a company in France called Aerolec to become number one in Europe. So anyway, we bought Siemens. We ended up buying Siemens in Germany. Subsequently, we bought Siemens in Scandinavia. And subsequently, we bought Siemens in Canada as they exited the business. Then we bought a very big French company called Moulaire that had half the French market. And the French market was the biggest in Europe for electric heating. Anyway, we ended up over time being the biggest manufacturer of electric heating in the world.
Amazing, yeah. Just to bring people to speed now, the company now has about 8,000 employees.
8,000 employees, privately owned.
And turnover of just shy of €1 billion, would that be about right?
A little bit more than that.
And they started from 10 employees in Newry, right?
In Newry.
So we've gone from 10 to 8,000. I mean, a lot of people coming in fresh to this story would say, here's a company based originally in Newry, obviously it opened up other sites later on, making electrical goods or white goods, as they're sometimes described, out of Ireland, going up against lower cost locations, potentially in Asia, maybe even in North America, Latin America, wherever, right? You know, if you put that business plan down on paper now and you went to someone with it and said...
It would look somewhat unlikely.
Yeah. So how did you do it, essentially? Like, how did you manufacture and distribute, I know not only out of Ireland, because you have plants all over the UK and so on, but how did this sort of European company, let's call it that, survive all those decades, be highly profitable in a very cost-conscious, price-conscious, price-sensitive categories? Like, what was it? Or is there one or two things you'd pick out and say, I think that was vital? Or
I think there are probably two factors. One was we aimed to have a low overhead operation, so our cost structure was lower than most of our competitors. We secondly had a criteria that every product had to be profitable. You didn't make a product and sell a product unless it made sufficient profits. And we were very focused on design. When Martin started the business in 73 with five or six colleagues, which was unusual for a company that was just starting life, he had a full-time director in charge of design. They'd yet to make a product. And they were very committed and focused on design, that your products had to look great, but be cheap to make. In other words, I remember when we bought Morphy Richards, they had the particularly leading iron, they were the leading iron manufacturer in the UK. One of their irons is something like 65 parts. We were able to get that iron back down to having 10 parts. Cheaper to assemble, less to go wrong with it. So the company was very focused on design, much more so than most of its competitors.
It sounds like a Dyson-type company of today. Would that sort of philosophy similar? I mean,
I think Dyson would be more radical. The invention of the Dyson vacuum cleaner was something new completely in the world. So I'd say we were making everyday products better, whereas Dyson made a brand new product that took over the market. So,
and what did you enjoy most about running that company or being a driving force yourself in the market? Like, what on a day-to-day basis, was it the growth? Was it the products? Was it, what was it that actually kept you going over the years? What was the bit you liked the most looking back? Because you stayed there a long time, right? So what was it? Was it just building it up from such shallow foundations, or what was it?
I didn't have a committee of boards to apply to. Martin and myself decided everything between us when we would talk. So just the sheer freedom, that was one thing. Making money, I enjoyed that. And being a success with the company growing, you enjoy, you know, your plans working out. And when they don't work out, you stop, break, fix it, go again. So I think sense of achievement.
How much did you call on the skills of your earlier career, your audit stuff and so on, or had you kind of shed that skin a little bit, or was that still coming back in? I mean, obviously you can read a balance sheet and a P&L and all the rest of it, but...
I'd say our financial reporting system was as sophisticated as anybody's. It was as good as you could get. And then you were able to hire people to run it.
And the division of labour between you and Martin, like who did what and who was in charge of what, or how did you split it up? Or
Martin was production and engineering and I was finance. Okay. But in effect, everything was discussed between us. So there's nothing really happened without us both agreeing or coming to a conclusion that this is a good idea.
So for the benefit of people in the audience, I was saying to Lachlan when we were preparing on Friday, I said, how does it feel when you come into the Quinn Business School and he sees students in hoodies and T-shirts with Quinn written on them? And he think you just found it sort of slightly strange, didn't you?
It's unusual.
It's unusual, yeah. So just to, because obviously the audience were speaking, how did the UCD connection come in? Obviously you're a graduate, so you have always that in your blood and you'll have that for all time. But what was the thing that... I know you're going to say to me Lawrence Crowley came to you and asked you, but presumably you were asked lots of things and ventures you could have gotten involved. What was it about the UCD thing?
Well, UCD set up the business school in Carysfort and they had an initial board of directors and I was asked to become one of them. And the chief executive of the business school, the first one, was Lawrence Crowley. Once every 2 months there'd be a meeting and there was usual sort of roundup of a group of guys in Dublin who were on the board, people like Martin Rafferty and various others. And I can't remember when the Smurfit School opened, but I think it'd be about 1991. And then about 10 years later, or maybe a little less, Lawrence came to me one day, my office, with the proposal that I kickstart the fund to build the Quinn School. And I said, I'll think about it. So I discussed it with my wife, and I came from a family of six. She came from a family of two, all of whom had gone to university. So we felt we'd been lucky. We went to university at a time when it wasn't that popular. Some of my children were now at university. So anyway, we discussed it briefly and went back to Lawrence. I said, OK, that's how it got started.
And when you walk through now, obviously... Dr. Hoolan's been showing you around and so on. I mean, what do you make of it now in 2024 as you see all the facilities and what you're looking at?
I think it's fantastic to see the interior of the building work much better than you could see from an architect's drawings. An architect's drawings, you basically see the envelope. But it's actually the inside of the building that seems to work so fantastically. And the other thing, like, you get a lot of comments from people I know who have children who've come here and who've enjoyed the spectacle, and they always say, oh, it's working out great. My son loved it, my daughter loved it, etc. So that's nice.
The student experience is important, yeah, to hear.
Yeah.
And parents will know, they'll hear, right? Yeah. They'll be the best arbiters of these things. In terms of other things that you've done, because this has obviously been a great successful project, obviously you've been involved in some state companies, ESB and AIB. How did you find, I mean, we'd see RTE going through a tough time, let's just put it that way at the moment. I was talking yesterday to the Institute of Directors who were saying it's hard to get people to go onto state boards for all sorts of reputational risk issues and so on. Did you enjoy that experience, those two boards? And why go on a state board in the sense that, you know, you're independently wealthy, you don't need to do this, etc.? What was it that drew you into doing those two particular roles?
Well, AIB was a lot earlier. I became chairman of AIB in 97. It was the first board I'd ever been on, apart from Glenn Dimplex. And in Glenn Dimplex, we had three on a board, so...
Short meetings, right?
Yeah. Jim Cullerton, who was ex-CEO of Cement Roadstone, which I think today is comfortably Ireland's biggest company. Jim Cullerton asked me to go on the board, and I'd never been on a board of any other company. So I said, yeah. And what I didn't realise was that 6 months later, Jim Cullerton told Saul he was going to step down. And I was asked to become chairman. And I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it for two reasons. One, it was successful at the time and making money. and growing. And secondly, I enjoyed the senior management working with them, particularly a guy called Tom Mulcahy, who was chief executive. We had a fraud which took place during
the Rusnak.
My so Rusnak.
John Rusnak. I'm sure you don't like to hear that name at this stage.
Look, you know, in the financial services, frauds happen all the time. And his fraud, like, it's a sad case. He gambled and lost money. He was a foreign exchange dealer. And to protect his bonus, he hid his losses. Instead of saying to somebody, sorry, I made a decision, I made a mistake, he didn't receive a penny of the money that disappeared. He ended up spending 6 years in jail and he lost his job. And he was the real victim. The share price of AIB recovered within 3 months. Once everybody knew, I had to make a decision one morning on the radio to announce how big the loss was, and that there'd be no, if I got that wrong, you'd look pretty stupid. But I had to put a stop to the trauma of the share price. I said, that's it, 750 million, no more, no less. Fortunately enough, it turned out to be right. It was 705 million. So I was close. But Rusnak was the real victim. And one or two people who were his superiors who had failed to check him. ESB was more straightforward, run by engineers. I'd known that happened a lot later. That was 2008. I'd left AIB in 2003. And I was asked by our current Green Minister, Eamon Ryan, whom I'd never met in my life, who asked me to come in. He said, would you become chairman of ESB? So I thought about it for a while. Just thought it might be interesting. And I was sort of semi-retired in terms of what I was doing.
Being a chairperson or a chairman, as you were, it's a different job, it's a different role than what you were used to in Glendinplex, say, for argument. Like, did you make that, did you feel you made that transition where you're...
Oh, it's very different. I mean, I've been quoted saying there's only two jobs you have to do as a chairman. Decide when you fire the chief executive. And if you don't do that, pick a successor. You're completely... If you don't trust the management, you shouldn't be in the job, because any decent chief executive and board of directors can sandbag a chairman. A chairman has to take and trust what he's told. And there's no way that you have a separate information system that tells you that what you're being told here is incorrect. So it's based on trust. And if you don't have that trust, you shouldn't take the job.
The other thing, you've such a wide variety of interests. Everyone knows about your vineyard, which is Chateau Fusel, correct pronunciation? You're obviously very involved in the art world. Are these things that you see, those two areas, do you see them as kind of passion projects type, or do you see them as not dissimilar to your business interests? Are they totally separate?
I've always been interested in art. I had a very good teacher at school whose great strength was to tell me I couldn't paint. I accepted that, but he taught me what to look for in a painting.
So you could buy paint.
And look at, well, enjoy.
Yeah.
Not even like when you're a schoolboy, you're not thinking about buying paintings. You're just looking at, appreciating what you're looking at or what to look for.
Actually, the first time I think the only time I've met you before this, you were actually down at an IMI conference. You used to go to the IMI conference?
I did,
that makes sense, yeah. And I think I might have been socialising with you at the bar after the evening, and I didn't know that your own private collection of art was so extensive. So you were saying to me something along the lines of the Jack B. Yeats paintings in the National Gallery are fine, but they're not particularly his best work. And I was sort of sitting there going, here's this guy telling us that our National Gallery doesn't have the right Jack B. Yeats. And then you spun around and said, they're definitely more, they're inferior to the ones I would own. Something along those lines. And I remember going, oh, right, okay. It's not just the acquisition of them. You like particular paintings, particular periods of different, like, not that you're picky, but you know what you're doing, you know? That's what comes across to me.
Yeah, I'd be reasonable knowledgeable going back. I mean, from buying Dutch old masters to contemporary American paintings out of collection, but mostly Irish.
If they said to you tomorrow, you can only take one, a kind of a desert island type choice?
Well, there's a Roderick O'Connor landscape of the south of France, which would be high in that list. But
so when you go to acquire them, do you go to the auctions or do you just do them remotely? Like, what actual purchase of the art, like, what's that like?
Well, first of all, there's auctions, which is probably the prime source of sales of art globally. Then there's dealers who know that you're a buyer of certain paintings by certain artists, and they will call you and say, look, I've got something such for you. Would you like to see it? And nowadays they send you an image by email, but going back 20 years ago or 30 years ago, they'd send you a colour snapshot, and you go to see it and say yes or no.
And then to talk about the winemaking, which I have to say I'm fascinated by, what made you get into French wine in the Bordeaux region? I think you spent about 36 million, according to, on the vineyard you acquired. Is that roughly about right or something of that?
Close.
Close enough, we won't fall out over. But it was a big purchase even for you, right? It was a big step. You obviously could have gone to other places. They don't come up for sale very often, as you were saying earlier. So what was it about the area, the terroir, as they call it? What made you go for that?
Bordeaux is the largest fine wine producer in the world. 10 times as much wine is made in Bordeaux as is made in Burgundy, for example. And Bordeaux has been the original global brand. Wherever you go in the world, you'll have the local wine list, and there'll always be Bordeaux wine on it. Sometimes you won't get Burgundy necessarily. American wine, rare enough, even still. And 20 years ago, American wine was much rarer on other... Because nearly everywhere in the world, people drink local. So the local wines in Alsace are mostly consumed in Alsace, et cetera, et cetera. In Provence, the rosé, which you're now starting to see in Ireland, is basically the daily tipple, but it's essentially a Provence wine. But Bordeaux is the biggest fine wine market. So when I decided I'd like to buy a vineyard, I decided on Bordeaux.
The other thing I wanted to ask you about, of course, is bringing it back to 2024. We've got a lot of young students here, some of whom I think one or two are students of mine sitting in front of me. What would you say to them now, looking at their careers? Obviously, it's a totally different time, late 50s and early 60s. You're a chartered accountant by training. Any advice for people in what they should be doing, studying, watching? Is there some things that you did that you now look back and say, that was something that I'm glad I did? It was a positive thing. It guided me in the later years. Or anything to advise them about if they want to get into business the way you did and make such a success of it? Is there anything they should be thinking about now, or is it just be very open-minded and curious?
Well, enjoy what you're doing, for starters. The second one is be lucky. You can make a lot of good decisions that don't work out, and you can make other decisions that do work out. Trying to track that down in advance is very difficult. I think luck's a very important part of life. And if you've succeeded, you don't necessarily want to claim there was a large element of luck involved, because it detracts from your ability.
We all like to think it's, yeah.
But there is a large element of luck involved in every success. You go into an industry at the right time. That same industry 5 years later or 5 years earlier might not have worked. I mean, that's a rather simplistic comment, but I just think being lucky is a very, not to be underrated, but what is also important is to enjoy what you're doing. You're more likely to be good at it, and you're more likely to work longer hours and harder hours, assuming you're not working from home. But
I'd like to see you doing the work from home thing. I think that would be really interesting to see. Yeah?
So enjoy what you're doing and cross your fingers.
Lachlan, one before you go, which I think we probably couldn't let you go before you leave, is the Irish economy, right? You've told a story here, different eras, the lack of jobs, the lack of penetration of university education when you were going to school and college. Are you optimistic or pessimistic, or maybe somewhere in the middle, about the Irish economy? It's doing well at the moment. We're almost at full employment. Obviously, there are various infrastructural issues and so on. House prices, of course, is there. But are you, for the next 5 years, say, for argument, if you were an investor or an employee or one of our young students here, would you be optimistic about the immediate horizon?
Yeah, like from where I'd be looking at it, I don't think it's ever been in better shape. There is the one dramatic problem, being able to access ownership of a house. That was taken pretty well for granted throughout most of my adult life. Growing up, you could buy a house on an ordinary income. And that is one sort of big... And it's not located just in Ireland. House buying is difficult in many countries. But as far as the economy is concerned, I would have thought it's never been a better time. Never been a better time. Remember back, I think the population, we had a thing called a Brexit moment in Ireland when we separated from the UK. We separated from our main market. A lot of people took the emotional decision. Yes, they were in favour of it. But Brexit in the UK was an emotional decision, not an economic decision. And we had a falling population from independence through 1970. Some believe when you have a falling population, there are more houses than there are buyers. And then the population grew. We had, I think, 1 million people at work for most of the first 50 years of this state. We then suddenly went to 2 million in a very short period of time, and we're now at something like 2.3 million or 2.4 million. These are amazing numbers, amazing numbers. So I would have thought for somebody young, energetic and ambition, never a better time.
It's great to hear. Yeah. I think that's great. It's been a great conversation. Thanks for coming into your home of sorts, right? It is a home of sorts. It's great for the students. They see the name every day. It's on their student card. It's on all the slides. It's on all the rest of it. So it's great, if nothing else, for them to put a face to the name. You do exist, and you're very much part of the community here. And thanks to Tony and Maeve as well for putting this event together, and the rest of the team. This will go out as a podcast after we close up. So I don't know if you've done a podcast with UCD before. Probably not.
No.
Guessing not. So there's another first. So we'll distribute that on our social media channels. You can get that on Twitter if you want next week. He looks at me skeptically, but it will be put out there. And it's great to have you along. And thanks for everyone for turning up. I know lunchtime, people are busy at other stuff, and I know the culture activities of the week are other priorities as well. So give everyone a Lachlan a round of applause. Thanks for coming. Now, if you enjoyed this week's episode of the UCD Business Impact Podcast, please subscribe to episodes on Apple Podcast or Spotify. We cover a broad range of topics with insights from business leaders around the world, so there's sure to be something there for everyone. I'd like to thank our production team of Beth Gormley and Mike Liffey. They work tirelessly in the background, sourcing interviewees, editing, promoting episodes, and everything in between. I've been your host, Emmett Oliver, and we hope you can join us next time on UCD Business Impact.